hppodcraft.com.
We had been put in the mood for ghosts that evening after an excellent dinner at our old friend Colwyn's by a tale of Fred Marchard's, the narrative of a strange personal visitation. Seen through the haze of our cigars and by the drowsy gleam of a coal fire, Colwyn's library, with its oak walls and dark old bindings, made a good setting for such evocations and ghostly experiences at first-hand being. After Machard's brilliant opening, the only kind acceptable to us, we proceeded to take stock of our group and tax each member for a contribution. There were eight of us, and seven contrived, in a manner more or less adequate, to fulfill the condition imposed. It surprised us all to find we could muster such a show of supernatural impressions, for none of us, excepting Marchard himself and young Phil Frenham, whose story was the slightest of the lot, had the habit of sending our souls into the invisible. So that on the whole, we had every reason to be proud of our seven exhibits, and none of us would have dreamed of expecting an eighth from our host.
We once again open in a library with a fire going, cigar smoke in the air, and a round of ghost stories.
That was the opening of The Eyes by Edith Wharton.
And we're going to be covering it here on our month of weird women on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you can find us at hppodcraft.com and on Patreon/Witch House Media.
That reader you just heard is Dana Pupkin, a good friend of mine, a lovely person, and a fantastic actress. You can see her as the lead word nerd in the film QWERTY, which we've talked about before, directed by another reader we have on sometimes, Bill Sebastian. And she's currently in the sci-fi short film Planet, which is playing this month at the Holly Shorts Film Festival here in Los Angeles, as well as the Crested Boot Film Festival in Colorado this September. And I'll tell you what, if you're ever doing a pub quiz, Dana is a ringer.
Oh.
You know what actor was born in Palo Alto in 1978?
No.
Dana does.
Hey!
It's James Franco. She came in with that one and won us the match. Dana, thanks for reading, and also thank you for the award that night. Here's another one for you. What American novelist was born in 1862, was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for her novel The Age of Innocence in 1921, and as a child, was known by her friends and family as Pussy Jones? Can you answer that one?
I'm guessing it's Edith Wharton.
That's right, Edith Wharton, today's author.
Pussy?
Yeah, Pussy Jones was a nickname she had as a kid. Her father's name was Jones, that's her maiden name.
Oh, I see.
I think in the late 19th, early 20th century, Pussy actually was a kind of a nickname or pet name that was more commonly used.
Sure.
I remember some years ago reading that Anais Nin, the author, used to date this guy, Hugh Guiler, and that was his nickname for her. He'd call her Pussy all the time. I just thought that was so odd, but
it is Anais Nin.
It is Anais Nin. Yeah, that's true. But and also it did have the connotation it has today. Maybe it wasn't as strongly known, but
Oh, right. There
was a late 19th century vaudeville act, the Barrison Sisters, and they used to have this routine called "Do You Want to See My Pussy?"
What?
They would raise their skirts and they had live kittens under there. So that was the joke.
That's Lords of Acid, man.
I know. Well, I thought that was, except that Lords of Acid probably wouldn't be able to do the same trick because, animal rights activists would be
after
them. Like, how did they have these live kittens hiding under their skirts? How long were they in there? That seems like kind of a dangerous routine.
It does not seem very humane in the slightest.
Some quick back-of-the-book bio on Edith before we get into the story. Edith Wharton, born in 1862, died in 1937. She was born into a tightly controlled society at a time when women were discouraged from achieving anything beyond a proper marriage. Wharton broke through these strictures to become one of America's greatest writers, author of The Age of Innocence, Ethan Frome, and The House of Mirth. She wrote over 40 books in 40 years, including authoritative works on architecture, gardens, interior design, and travel.
Man.
She was the first woman awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, an honorary doctorate of letters from Yale University, and a full membership in the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She was born to George Frederick Jones and Lucretia Stevens Rhinelander in New York. They were wealthy. It's actually said that the phrase "keeping up with the Joneses" was a reference to her father's family.
What?
You've heard that one before. Edith traveled a lot as a child and as an adult, spending a good portion of every year in Europe. She wrote her first novella when she was 15.
Wow.
But of course, this was not a proper occupation for a lady. When she published in her young life, she often had to do it under a pseudonym, or I think she attributed it to an uncle at certain points, or she published just for a small audience of her relatives and friends. It was really only in her 40s that she was able to comfortably publish as herself. This was after divorcing her husband of 28 years. Wharton was friend and confidant to many gifted intellectuals of her time, Henry James, Sinclair Lewis, Jean Cocteau. She was pals with Teddy Roosevelt.
Whoa.
Clearly acquainted well with the rich and the jet set. Her novels and short stories realistically portrayed the lives and morals of the late 19th century, an era of decline and faded wealth. But as we'll see today, she also fancied ghost stories and the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
On top of all those other accolades, she was nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1927, wow. 1928, and 1930.
Jeez. Man, she dropped the ball in 1929.
Yeah, no kidding. What was going on in 29, Edith? Eventually, she settled in France. She actually did quite a bit of work for the French war effort during World War I, and she passed away in 1937. She had just as interesting a life as you might imagine, being both privileged, but also, you know, kept down because of her gender at the same time. I'd recommend further reading on Edith's life, but for now, let's just get into the story.
Yeah, it begins with a group of friends, all men, having a men's party in the style of the 19th century, with rich white guys sitting around in suits, smoking cigars, drinking brandy. The host of this party is Mr. Andrew Colwyn, an old fellow who has a reputation as a brilliant writer and as a mentor to many young writers. At this party, his newest protege, Phil Frenham, is there as well as our narrator, who goes unnamed. The narrator says that Colwyn is a squat, unappealing man who was supposed to be quite the charmer in the old days.
Yeah, Colwyn is described as a spectator, a humorous, detached observer of the immense, muddled variety show of life. And so it's quite a surprise, as noted in the end of the opening there, that he would offer up any kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
Usually his duties are just to be a host. I kind of got the impression from that as well that it's equally surprising that he, you know, he's got this detached, I don't really participate in things, but maybe also he's not good at telling stories, and so he has that air about him because he doesn't want to contribute. I also think it's interesting that in that opening they describe Phil Frenham's as being kind of the worst ghost story they heard. It was very slight.
Yeah.
So his mentee is maybe not the best either. There's some rumors about Colwyn's young life. It says there's a vague tradition of his having in a remote period and in a romantic clime been wounded in a duel. But this legend no more tallied with what we younger men knew of his character than my mother's assertion that he had once been a charming little man with nice eyes. So yeah, like you said, he was supposed to be quite a charmer in the old days. But it's hard for them to imagine that. The narrator's pretty honest about that's such a strange thought because we look at him and we think he, quote, can never have looked like anything but a bundle of sticks. Somebody else says, or a phosphorescent log, rather.
I can't quite put that into an image.
Yeah, I think that just means that, you know, like a log, he's got that barky kind of texture to his skin. Sounds like the emperor or something, you know. His dispassionate survey of the universe had not raised his opinion of that costly experiment, and his study of the human race seemed to have resulted in the conclusion that all men were superfluous and women necessary only because someone had to do the cooking. On the importance of this point, his convictions were absolute, and gastronomy was the only science which he revered as dogma.
Mm.
So the guy is a bon vivant, he loves food, but to him, people seem to be somewhat disposable.
Yeah.
Or at least that's kind of the image that he's cultivated.
His new young protege, Phil, is a handsome young man. The narrator says this about him. Young Phil Frenham was the last and the most interesting of these recruits, and a good example of Murchard's somewhat morbid assertion that our old friend liked him juicy.
Whoa.
So Colwyn found him living a boring, comfortable life and pulled him into this world of ideas and inspiration. The narrator says this, the skill with which Colwyn had contrived to stimulate his curiosities without robbing them of their young bloom of awe, seemed to me a sufficient answer to Murchard's ogreish metaphor.
Hmm.
So I think what is in the subtext here is that Colwyn is gay,
mm-hmm.
and that these young men are people that he gets into relationships with.
Right.
I read this article about this story by Stephen Cordova talking about the homosexual aspects of the story. At the time the story was set, Cordova says that it was common for gay men to get into long-term relationships by someone being a mentor to someone else.
Right.
The author, it could be expected, knew about these kinds of arrangements. It said, Warden had other examples of self-pleasing, uncommitted bachelors to draw on from her own life, and she used that as fuel for this particular story.
It's pretty clear that she knows this particular type of bachelor.
Not to say that this is a negative thing. As mm-hmm. I quoted earlier, Colwyn was good in relationships. I don't know if you ever listened to Dan Savage. He does a Savage Love podcast.
Yeah, I've read his column.
So he's got this thing called the campsite rule. It's if you're in a sexual relationship with somebody significantly younger or less experienced than you, the rule is the same rule that applies to campsites, that you must leave them in at least as good a condition physically and emotionally as you found them.
Okay.
When you get involved with somebody who might not be as experienced as you,
yeah,
not necessarily younger, just somebody that maybe you've been around a block or had a faster life than mm-hmm. somebody who, I was a late bloomer myself, so mm-hmm. pretty much everybody had more experience than me. But it's important that you just, even if it doesn't last a long time, that relationship, that when you're with them, you try to be a good person to them and show them the ropes,
yeah,
and not take advantage of their naivete.
Right.
And it seems like he, in the story, that Colwyn wasn't really taking advantage of them, that he really kind of helps them. It's kind of a symbiotic relationship. He helps them as a mentor, and then, you know, he gets to enjoy their company.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems that way. Although, Phil, it said that he drew him out of what was kind of, in his eyes, a boring life.
Yes.
And got him excited about art and literature stuff. We'll see if that damages him or not. You know, it might be that he gave him some ideas of his own importance that might not bear out. But we'll see. I don't know.
True. So all the guests tell ghost stories, everyone taking a turn, but Colwyn, who usually holds court, like you said, just observing. As the party winds down, Colwyn, Frenham, and the narrator go off to a more quiet conversation.
It seems like this is a kind of normal conclusion of his parties, where people will start leaving and then the circle tightens until it's just a few people talking a little more intensely.
Frenham points out that Colwyn didn't tell any stories, and he chides him a bit, saying that with his experience, he's probably seen more than one ghost.
In private, he said, "I believe that story about the duel. Like, Colwyn's awesome." In the room, he says, "There's no way you don't have a story to tell. And if you don't have a story where you've seen a ghost, that's because you have a story where you've seen two ghosts," which is some pretty good hype man work that he's doing there.
Sure, yeah. And that pulls Colwyn into his tale, where he did indeed see two ghosts. And that gets us into the second chapter. He starts off by saying that his ghost story is pretty weak sauce compared to most. It might have been a problem with his eyes or some kind of illness, though he had no reason to think that he was ill. His story begins when he was a young man. He traveled to South America and Mexico, and then he returned to America, where he stayed with his aunt in New York.
An old aunt who had known Washington Irving, and she lives in this damp Gothic villa.
So while staying with his aunt, resting up and saving some money, he decides that he's going to write a book, about which he forgets now. He has no idea. He's like, "It was really important at the time. I can't even remember what I was going to do this stupid book about." But that's not important to the story.
Well, I thought it was such a funny bit about Colwyn's character. A few times in the story, he's working on some great book, but he never finishes it, and he doesn't even remember what he was writing about. I think he's somewhat self-aware of the fact that he's just a rich guy who flirts with these things and he doesn't finish them.
Right.
Because then that would serve him up for judgment by others. Yet he's got no problem mentoring these young authors.
Yes.
Which is strange. But while at first he was tired when he got to his aunt's, once he's rested up, he gets restless and the place is kind of stuffy for him. He thinks, "I'll throw my whole energy into writing this book." The setting does seem like a pretty great place to write a book. He says, "My aunt, impressed by my plan, gave up to me her Gothic library filled with classics in black cloth and daguerreotypes of faded celebrities. And I sat down at my desk to make myself a place among their number. And to facilitate my task, she lent me a cousin to copy my manuscript."
His cousin lived there as well. She was a nice girl who was neither beautiful nor intelligent. Poor Alice Nowell.
So this is the plain Jane who's going to help him prepare his manuscript, and she's staying in the house to boot.
But she seems so content with her life, and that makes Colwyn very curious. In trying to find out why she's so content with her life, he says the wrong thing to her, and it seems to really put her off. She has kind of lived this sheltered life and has only ever seen her cousins.
"I wanted to find out the secret of her content. In doing this, I handled it rather rashly and put it out of joint." Oh, just for a moment. So what did he say to her?
Yeah, I don't know. I was wondering that myself.
I feel like he said what he just said to us. Like, "Hey, you seem content with being plain and boring and stupid. What's your secret?" You know? I think he just blurted it out to her. But now he feels bad about it. He wants to put things straight, but he doesn't know how.
This puts him off for a bit, and he felt like it's time for him to kind of move out of this house and go do something else. Like, it's not working for him. So one night, she comes into the library where he's working, and he tells her that he's leaving for Europe that week, and she just says goodbye. As she said it, she looked straight at me and kissed me, and I never felt anything as fresh and shy and brave as her kiss. It was worse than any reproach, and it made me ashamed to deserve a reproach from her. I said to myself, "I'll marry her, and when my aunt dies, she'll leave us this house, and I'll sit here at the desk and go on with my book, and Alice will sit over there in her embroidery and look at me as she's looking at me now, and life will go on like that for any number of years." He gives Alice his seal ring and he says, "I want you to marry me and I want you to come to Europe with me." And she's like, "Okay, this is great."
Yeah, this seemed to me right here to be the kind of original sin of the ghost story. I've definitely had moments like this where you try to talk yourself into settling on something, on some kind of normality. Maybe you're beat down by the things you're trying to do. You know, "I'm just going to stay at this job and settle."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you do make those decisions, it's a little like what he experiences. You see your life laid out. It's comforting in some ways, but it's mostly depressing. You go, "I'll just be here till I retire, and then I'll go have a nice house with somebody and forget all this big shot stuff I want to do with my life. I'm going to settle for this." Sometimes in the moment, it's the most comforting decision to make. Mm-hmm. It's odd that Alice's reaction isn't characterized. You say she's like, great, but honestly, he doesn't say how she reacts.
No.
She clearly accepts the proposal, but it's just assumed she's happy to have somebody marry her.
Yeah.
Obviously, she kissed him, so...
Yeah, she's obviously into him or has the potential of maybe actually finding a sexual partner.
Yeah.
Which is something that she doesn't have a lot of opportunities for. Now, that night, while he's in bed, something happens. His heart's kind of heavy, and he's thinking about he's going to finally now step into the adult world. He's going to be taking responsibility for himself and for his life and a little bit for the world and society.
He's going out of his way as well to point out that this decision must be related to the haunting he then experiences. He says, being at that time an ardent believer in a necessary sequence between cause and effect, I naturally tried to trace some kind of link between what had just happened to me in my aunt's library and what was to happen a few hours later on the same night.
Lying in the dark, he has the feeling that something or someone is there in the room with him. And from the darkness at the foot of his bed, he sees two eyes staring at him. The face is shrouded in darkness, so he can't make it out at all, but the eyes themselves seem to glow very faintly.
The sensation of being thus gazed at was far from pleasant, and you might suppose that my first impulse would have been to jump out of bed and hurl myself at the invisible figure attached to the eyes. But it wasn't. My impulse was to simply lie still. I can't say whether this was due to an immediate sense of the uncanny nature of the apparition, to the certainty that if I did jump out of bed, I should hurl myself on nothing, or merely to the benumbing effect of the eyes themselves. They were the very worst eyes I've ever seen. A man's eyes. But what a man. My first thought was that he must be frightfully old. The orbits were sunk, and the thick red-lined lids hung over the eyeballs like blinds of which the cords are broken. One lid drooped a little lower than the other, with the effect of a crooked leer. And between these pulpy folds of flesh, with their scant bristle of lashes, the eyes themselves, small glassy discs with an agate-like rim about the pupils, looked like sea pebbles in the grip of a starfish. But the age of the eyes was not the most unpleasant thing about them. What turned me sick was their expression of vicious security. I don't know how else to describe the fact that they seemed to belong to a man who had done a lot of harm in his life, but had always kept just inside the danger lines. They were not the eyes of a coward, but of someone much too clever to take risks, and my gorge rose at their look of base astuteness.
Those danger lines, once you do cross over into that, that gets you into the danger zone. Right into the danger zone.
Of course, I heard the same thing in my head when I read that.
Everybody did.
Everybody heard it. That last line tells you a lot, that last line of that reading. I think it's directly related to this decision that he's just made to get married, obviously. Mm-hmm. It says, they were not the eyes of a coward, but of someone much too clever to take risks. Mm-hmm. And my gorge rose at their look of a base astuteness. Base astuteness. So somehow in these eyes, he sees a person who is astute. Meaning that this person can read a situation very well.
Yeah.
Based on that astuteness, knows not to take certain risks.
Yeah.
Also, someone who has done a lot of harm, but is kept inside the danger lines. It says they have an expression of vicious security, which was an interesting phrase.
Yeah.
I think there's obvious connections to be made here to sexuality, pursuing something in private rather than in honesty in public.
Sure.
Or at least even in honesty between you and the other partner. That can also be expanded to cover all sorts of things. The harm that can come when a person isn't honest about their wants, you know, when they are too worried about how they'll look.
Sure.
And so they pursue a different path to get what they want.
Colwyn is overcome by rage and he throws himself at the eyes, but of course there's nothing there. He goes back to bed, but the eyes return. He knows they aren't real, but he wonders if it's an outward optical illusion or if it's something inside of him that's making him see these eyes.
Yeah, is it just some light or some trick of the room that's making him see these, or is he going nuts? For if they were a projection of my inner consciousness, what the deuce was the matter with that organ?
He tries to think of Alice, and he kind of pictures her kind, plain face, and that, you know, he's doing the right thing by marrying her, but the eyes still remain.
And even within his imagining, he's got to throw some digs down on Alice, you know? They were not remarkable eyes, but they were as wholesome as fresh water. And if she had had more imagination, or longer lashes, their expression might have been interesting. Like, man, even when you're conjuring up her picture, you're not even doing anything to make it more appealing to you. You are clearly doing the wrong thing with your life. And the eyes bother him all night. It says, I can't tell you what that night was, nor how long it lasted. Have you ever lain in bed, hopelessly wide awake, and tried to keep your eyes shut, knowing that if you opened them, you'd see something you dreaded and loathed? It sounds easy, but it's devilish hard. Those eyes hung there and drew me.
When he wakes up, Coleman packs his things and he leaves without telling anyone. He goes over to a friend's house to try and get some sleep.
Which really filled me with jealousy. It says, when I reached town, I didn't go to the doctor's. I went to a friend's rooms and threw myself on a bed and slept for 10 heavenly hours.
Wow.
When I woke up, it was the middle of the night. I turned cold at the thought of what might be waiting for me. I sat up shaking and stared into the blackness, but there wasn't a break in its blessed surface. And when I saw that the eyes were not there, I dropped back into another long sleep. So 10 hours, and then he goes back to sleep?
Wow.
Coleman is doing some pretty cowardly stuff here, though. He left without saying anything to Alice.
Of course.
So he proposed to her, and then he just scrammed.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I didn't say anything because I figured I'd go back the next day. But, you know, he's so well-rested, he goes, maybe another day. I'll pass it, my friends.
Yep.
And then another day. And, I mean, you know, Alice must think he clearly ditched me.
Because he did.
Finally, after a third, and the eyes went away, right? Because he got out of that situation. Finally, after a third day, he decides, I'm going to go back. I'm going to make things right. But when he gets comfortable with that decision, that's when he sees the eyes again.
He jumps on a boat that's headed to Europe. And when he sleeps on the boat, though, the eyes are gone. And of course, he still has left no word for Alice.
Once again, he's just fleeing from his problems. And in a pretty extreme way, just catching a ship for England.
Yeah.
But the strange inversion here is that rather than be punished for shirking responsibility, running away from it makes the eyes disappear. So it's an irresponsible thing to do, but he is running away from a commitment that he shouldn't have made. And that's why the eyes disappear.
So he stays in Europe for a year, never seeing the eyes, and he gets to the point where he thinks maybe he never really saw them.
I had perfectly come to see on the voyage over the folly, complete impossibility of my marrying Alice Nowell. The fact that I had been so slow in making this discovery annoyed me. It made me want to avoid explanations. It's like obvious to everybody else, you know. The bliss of escaping at one stroke from the eyes and from this other embarrassment gave my freedom an extraordinary zest, and the longer I savored it, the better I liked its taste. He's so dense in that he's careful now to say these two things are related, but I guess at the time he thought they were two separate things.
Yeah.
The eyes went away at the same time that I ran away from this marriage.
Yeah.
Strange.
That was a crappy way to ditch her, but
yeah.
I think he ultimately did her a service.
Absolutely. In a way, he did her a better service because he didn't come up with some excuse as to why it couldn't happen. He just showed his nature, which is that he's kind of a coward. So
yeah.
She can go, I'm better off. I dodged a bullet.
So his second year, he ends up in Rome.
Once again, he's working on some book. I was planning, I believe, to write another great book, a definitive work on Etruscan influences in Italian art. So it's like he's working on this book that never gets written. And again, he's not completely sure if that's even what it was about. Yeah, it really exposes his character.
While he's working on this new book, a young man shows up.
Yeah, he's in the forum doing his research on whatever it is he's writing about, and he sees him.
As he stood there in the warm light, slender and smooth and hyacinthine.
He looks like he just stepped right out of myth. And clearly Coleman is much more impressed by the guy than he ever was by Alice.
Yep. This guy has a letter from Alice explaining that he is Gilbert Noyes, her cousin, and that he wants to be a writer. She asks Coleman if he would take him under his wing for a time, and Coleman is excited at the chance to repay Alice for the way that he treated her by doing her this favor. Also, Gilbert seems to be Coleman's type of guy.
Yeah, there's a little between the lines, you realize, so Alice knows where he is.
Yes.
Enough that she can send him this letter, or she can send the guy to him with the letter. So She clearly has gotten over what's happened and moved on, you know. Gilbert's just getting 6 months while he's over there, though. He doesn't have enough money to do more than that. And if he's not able to demonstrate some talent, then he's going to have to pack up, go back to New York, and do a desk job of some sort on Wall Street. So He's just got a little bit of cash to travel with. I feel like he's gone to the exact wrong person for guidance.
Yes.
I mean, remember that line. They seem to belong to a man who had done a lot of harm in his life, but it always kept just inside the danger line.
Yep.
Coleman feels like it would put him at risk to just say to Gilbert, you know what? You're cute. Let's spend some time together having some fun. Instead, he's going to falsely mentor him, puff him up, just so he sticks around.
Yeah.
Also, it seems like everybody Coleman meets, he characterizes as plain and stupid. Or stupid. And it makes me wonder if he isn't just saying these things to puff himself up a little bit.
He says that Noyes wasn't a predestined genius, but he was beautiful to see and charming as a comrade, too.
Yeah, has to insult his intellect.
Coleman says that Gilbert is so charming that he often passes for clever at parties and such.
Man.
What a jerk. The months were delightful. Noyes was constantly with me. The more I saw of him, the better I liked him. His stupidity was a natural grace. It was beautiful, really, as his eyelashes. You know, eyelashes come up a lot in this story.
He's into eyelashes. Gilbert's the one that's got him, and Alice didn't have him.
That's right.
Maybe it's not eyelashes he's talking about that she didn't have.
And he was so gay, so affectionate, and so happy with me that telling him the truth would have been about as pleasant as slitting the throat of some artless animal.
Jeez.
Artless animal. Not just an animal. an artless animal.
Just like when he proposed to Alice, he's not really being honest with his intent, even to himself.
No. Now, Gilbert really believes that he could be a writer, but Coleman knew that he just didn't have it in him. So he tried to teach Gilbert while not being too caught up in his charms. The two of them left for Rome, and they stayed in the countryside. They had a wonderful time. He was never more enchanting and enchanted. When they got back to Rome, he knows he has to put the kibosh on Gilbert's dream. So Coleman sends Gilbert to publishers and other writers with the hopes that they'll be honest with him about his work.
But they keep sending his work back with no comments at all, which is the worst reaction. They probably read a couple sentences in and went, hell no.
Yeah.
This is not even worth putting that time into.
So as he sits to talk to him, he sees Gilbert has written a whole novel. And Coleman is ready to break it down to him, but then he sees Gilbert go pale and he just chickens out.
The more I looked at the part I'd resolved to play, the less I liked it. And I liked it still less when Gilbert sat opposite me with his head thrown back in the lamplight, just as Phil's is now. He makes that quick parallel between Gilbert and his new mentee, Phil, as if they're kind of the same person.
Yeah.
He just can't break it to Gilbert that he's a terrible writer.
He was too beautifully brave for me to keep up any humbug about my duty, and it came over me suddenly how I should hurt others in hurting him. Myself first, since sending him home meant losing him, but more particularly, poor Alice Noel, to whom I had so uneasily longed to prove my good faith and my immense desire to serve her. It really seemed like failing her twice to fail Gilbert. I said to myself, I shall have him for life, and I never yet see anyone, man or woman, whom I was quite sure of wanting on those terms.
Right. So once again, he's going, I'm going to have a future with this person, even though it's going to be predicated on a lie. Because he knows if he's honest with him about his work, the relationship's over. And then he goes, well, this impulse of egotism decided me. I was ashamed of it. And to get away from it, I took a leap that landed me straight in Gilbert's arms. The thing's all right and you're all wrong, I shouted up at him. And as he hugged me and I laughed and shook in his incredulous clutch, I had for a minute the sense of self-complacency that is supposed to attend the footsteps of the just. Hang it all, making people happy has its charms. It's true. Nothing feels better than rewarding somebody.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it insincerely, it's a terrible thing to do.
Of course. So Coleman tells Gilbert that they will work together on this book. They part, and Coleman goes up to his room. He says this interesting line here. He says, I sent him away alone to explode his emotions and went to bed to sleep off mine. As I undressed, I began to wonder what their aftertaste would be. So many of the finest don't keep. Still, I wasn't sorry, and I meant to empty the bottle, even if it turned a trifle flat. He's a bit of a user and a loser. He really seems to be embracing his selfish feelings. Mm-hmm. Almost 3 years since he sees the eyes again in his bed.
Of course he does, because he's just done this terrible thing to the guy.
But it's not enough to say that they were as bad as they were before. They were worse. Worse by just so much as I learned of life in the interval, by all the damnable implications my wider experience read into them.
Mm-hmm.
I began to wonder if they would let up on me if I abandoned Gilbert. The temptation was insidious, and I had to stiffen myself up against it. But really, dear boy, he was too charming to be sacrificed to such demons. And so, after all, I never found out what they wanted. So that gets into chapter 3. Now we're back in the present day with old Coleman having just told the story. The narrator says that he's like, oh, wait, that's it? Wait, you're stopping? That's the end of the story? So he asks, how long did you keep seeing them?
And now during this, Phil, his new mentee, seems to have an inkling of what's really going on.
Right.
He's been silent the whole story, just listening, but it's mentioned a small mirror in a bronze frame standing on the table behind him. He turned and changed its angle slightly. Then he resumed his former attitude, his dark head thrown back on his lifted palm, his eyes intent on Colwyn's face. Something in the stare embarrassed me, the narrator says. Fills on to what this whole story is about.
Yeah. So the narrator says it was like Coleman forgot what he was talking about. He's lost in thought. And finally, he continues the story. So he says he saw the eyes every night for a whole winter, never got used to them. And it turns out that he didn't end up dumping Gilbert. Gilbert dumped him. Seems Gilbert wore out not only Coleman, but everyone in their social circle. He just became a whiny baby about his work and his art. And people just kind of got sick of him. Mm-hmm. His charm wasn't enough. So Coleman always thought that Gilbert would be fine as a hanger-oner, you know, like in an entourage kind of position. He said, a charming parasitic thing, the kind of chronic cherubino for whom, in old societies, there's always a seat at the table and a shelter behind the lady's skirts. I saw him take his place as the poet, and then quotes, the poet who doesn't write. One knows the type in every drawing room.
Isn't he kind of describing himself?
Yes.
He's the poet who doesn't write anything?
Yes. Well, maybe, you know, he's like, my life's been pretty good being a me. I don't know if he doesn't seem self-aware enough to realize that's what he is. But he was trying to set up Gilbert to be like himself. Colwyn thought that he would be able to leech for a bit until he got married to some wealthy widow. In fact, Colwyn had one all lined up for him. But of course, Gilbert wanted to be a writer and he would not settle. And then Gilbert got angry at Colwyn and accused him of deceiving him, but Colwyn defended himself. He said, he'd come to me determined to write and I'd done my best to help him. That was the extent of my offense and I'd done it for his cousin's sake, not his.
Please, he didn't really try to help him. It was all about himself.
He told Gilbert to take a job as Mrs. Ellinger's secretary, which is the lady he was trying to hook him up with, and work his way into eventually marrying her. But this angered Gilbert and he went out in a storm and he asked Colwyn point blank, then you really think my stuff's no good. And then Colwyn just laughs.
I was tired and exasperated, and I laughed. I don't defend my laugh. It was in wretched taste. But I must plead in extenuation that the boy was a fool, and that I'd done my best for him. I really had. He really had not.
Gilbert went to his room. That day, Colwyn left and never went back.
He leaves Gilbert, and what do you know, the eyes disappear. And he gets that same lethargic sleep in. When he finally gets back to their place, Gilbert is gone. He packed up his stuff, went to America, quote, for his family and the Wall Street desk. And that gets us into the final chapter.
So the narrator suspects that maybe something happened to Gilbert. This is going to have one of those horrible twist endings. But he says, oh no, nothing became of him because he became nothing. There could be no question of becoming about it. He vegetated in an office, I believe, and finally got a clerkship in a consulate, and he married drearily in China. I saw him once in Hong Kong, years afterwards. He was fat and hadn't shaved. I was told he drank. He didn't recognize me.
So he became a broken, ugly old man like Colwyn.
So Colwyn says that the eyes never returned after that.
I never saw them after my last talk with Gilbert. Put two and two together if you can. For my part, I haven't found the link. So he's still unself-aware and oblivious even in his old age.
Phil, the protege, locks eyes with Colwyn and he flings his arms across the table and drops his face into his arms.
Phil, what the deuce? Why have the eyes scared you?
Cheer up, my dear Phil. It's been years since I've seen them. Apparently I've done nothing lately bad enough to call them out of the chaos, unless my present evocation of them has made you see them, which would be the worst stroke yet.
Right, and remember that there's this mirror behind Phil that he himself has adjusted so that Colwyn can see himself.
Phil, my dear boy, really, what's the matter? Why don't you answer? Have you seen the eyes?
Frenham's face was still pressed against his arms. And from where I stood behind Colwyn, I saw the latter, as if under the rebuff of this unaccountable attitude, draw back slowly from his friend. As he did so, the light of the lamp on the table fell full on his perplexed, congested face, and I caught its sudden reflection in the mirror behind Frenham's head. Colwyn saw the reflection also. He paused, his face level with the mirror as if scarcely recognizing the countenance in it as his own. But as he looked, his expression gradually changed, and for an appreciable space of time, he and the image in the glass confronted each other with a glare of slowly gathering hate. Then, Colwyn let go of Frenham's shoulders and drew back a step, covering his eyes with his hands. Frenham, his face still hidden, did not stir.
That's the end of the story. And the eyes were clearly his own eyes looking back through time, or maybe just a metaphor for his own guilt.
Yeah.
This story clearly deals with sexuality, although also on a larger level. I think it's just that, as I mentioned before, it's just being dishonest for the sake of some kind of safety.
Right.
If you're hiding something that's true about yourself for the sake of fitting in, you do spend a lot of time in misery, whether you know that's the cause or not, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It seems apparent. And this is a good example of someone not following the campsite rule.
That's right. Yeah, he's pretty much ruining these people.
Yeah.
By encouraging whatever he's got to encourage to keep them around.
For his own ends, not theirs. He doesn't really ultimately care about what happens to them, just as long as they're there to keep him happy.
This wasn't necessarily a weird tale as much as it was a ghost story, but it certainly had subtext that we don't encounter a lot in other things we read.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was really cool.
Well, it's not so much a ghost story.
You're right. It's not as much a ghost story as it is a supernatural story. There's this weird occurrence that happens as a result of the internal lives of the characters, right?
Well, you said it for me right there. Thank you very much.
Which, but it was a neat device, and I kind of had an idea that that's where it was going, but it's still,
yeah.
It speaks to a behavior that persists even today, I think.
I thought it was really well written too. Edith Wharton, a very talented lady, and it shows in this piece.
She won the Pulitzer, was nominated for the Nobel Prize, but she's finally gotten the brass ring that all writers seek out, which is approval from two podcast hosts in 2018.
No, I would like to read more of her stuff.
I want to thank Dana Pupkin for being our reader today. Also, thanks to our patrons for pitching in and keeping us alive. I want to name a few of them right now, starting with Nyra Lathicat. Yeah.
Archie Homer.
Harry Murphy.
Tim Hofsummer.
Thomas. One name only.
M.R. Zeal or Mr. Zeal. I guess it's Mr. Zeal, isn't it?
It's either M.R. Zeal or Mr. Zeal, but I think Mr. Zeal's awesome. It kind of gives you an idea about how he goes about life, you know?
Mr. Zeal.
Phil Esterbrook.
Clay Cobb.
D.C. Initials only.
Nils Hedgeland.
And Michael Townley. Thank you guys so much for being patrons. We're going to be back with more Weird Women next week. What are we doing?
We are doing Daphne du Maurier's Don't Look Now.
I'm excited about that. That's going to be a two-parter because that one's a little longer. So we'll be back next week with that story. I hope you tune in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.